live on DAB, smart speakers, apps, and at colorful.com. This is Colorful.
11 people have now died as the two biggest fires devastating Los Angeles County get yet bigger. Parts of the area have been alight since Tuesday. Several neighbourhoods have burnt to the ground. 10,000 homes have been destroyed. Deanne Criswell's from the US government's Emergency Management Agency.
This situation is still very dangerous. The winds have died down today, but as I just got a weather briefing, the winds are going to increase again in the coming days, and so people still need to stay vigilant.
A protection zone's been set up after an outbreak of bird flu was discovered in Scotland. The country's chief vet has confirmed that it's in Angus. After a tough week for the UK economy, the Chancellor says she's sticking to her plans. Rachel Reeves is in China, a trip aimed at strengthening links with Beijing and boosting trade. Back home, borrowing costs have soared. And today marks 25 years since the so-called gay ban in the armed forces was lifted. It's been marked by an announcement that a memorial for LGBT veterans will be built at the National Memorial Arboretum. That's the latest from Radio News Hub. I'm John Collins.
Right now at B&Q and Trade Point, get 3 for 2 on Dulux and Valspar interior paint, including white paint and Valspar paint mixing. So from walls to woodwork, you can freshen up your space for less. Shop in-store, online or on the app. You can do it when you B&Q it. Ends 20th of January. Exclusions apply. See DIY.com.
Coming up, metaphorically speaking...
Angela Rippon, what are you doing here?
I've come to tell you about using energy flexibly, Albert.
Flexibly?
Yes, smart meter owners could get rewarded for moving their energy use, like doing the laundry at off-peak times.
So I don't need to do the splits?
No, Albert. Nobody wants to see that.
Get rewarded for using energy flexibly, only with a smart meter. Search Get a Smart Meter today.
Eligibility and availability vary. Consumer action required. Reward schemes and tariffs available to selected customers from selected suppliers.
I never thought of myself as the giving type, but I guess I am. I cook my housemate an extra delicious pot of stew after a long night shift, and I give blood when I can. Investing 1 hour of my time can save up to 3 lives, like the life of my little cousin, Jace, who suffers from sickle cell. But you wouldn't know that by how cheeky he is. If you're the giving type in Brixton, please book an appointment at blood.co.uk.
Yes! I just can't believe it!
This time tomorrow, you could be a millionaire. Get your lotto ticket for tonight's draw. The National Lottery. Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or
soulful
over.
Soulful music. On Colourful.
Colorful Radio.
The world's home for soulful music hits. Coming up.
I want you in Hennessy on me tight. Think I'm way too sober.
Cha-cha with me, baby. I can shake and dance with you all night.
Metaphorically speaking.
And welcome to this very special episode of Metaphorically Speaking, celebrating St. Lucia's Nobel Laureate Festival. The tiny 238-square-mile Caribbean island boasts of having 2 Nobel laureates. Sir William Arthur Lewis received his prize for development economics in 1979, and Sir Derek Alton Walcott received his prize for literature in 1992. For the last 32 years, St. Lucians around the world have come together to celebrate the incredible achievements of their 2 renowned Nobel laureates in January, as both of them were born on the 23rd of January. I'm Delia Delore. This is the podcast where we explore the origin, usage and meaning of the popular expressions and phrases that shape the world we live in. This episode is special, as it is an opportunity to speak to St. Lucians, who, like her 2 Nobel laureates, strive for excellence in their various fields. In the past, we have spoken to a poet in St. Lucia, a rum distiller in Scotland, and a designer in the United States. They have all unlocked their potential, which is within every one of us, to affect the world in a meaningful and positive way. St. Lucia has always been a very precious place for me, especially in January when we celebrate the Nobel laureates. I was very honoured and privileged to know Sir Derek Walcott personally. And so him not being here now,
I can see him sometimes sitting at Government House reading his poetry. I can see him at the beach painting. I can see him at home laughing. And many people, I think, would agree with me by saying as he got older, he became more jovial. And the people who perhaps did not approach him in his younger years would feel more comfortable to approach him in his elder years. And he was just such a wonderful person to know. And his creativity and his mind made you feel that you could be creative too, and you could do whatever you wanted to do. And he was always proud of St. Lucians who stuck to what they wanted to do and achieved. And I think achievements can be in varying levels, but once you try and you try your best, I think that is the best that anyone can expect of, you know, for you. And once you know that you've done your best, you can feel good that you've done the best that you could. And Sir Derek always said that about others. And no doubt, Sir Arthur, being a lecturer himself, it would have been very important for him to make people understand in layman's terms how economics affected the rest of the world. And of course, he's not here now, but the rest of the world listen. And a lot of his principles have been employed worldwide. Well, it's a metaphor that has been used to describe everything from politics to Hollywood, from the world of business to the world of opera. That metaphor is climbing the greasy pole. And it has been given to us by our special guest for this episode, born in St. Lucia, the first black consultant, ophthalmic plastic surgeon in the UK, and TV personality of The Face Doctors, Mr. Cornelius Rennie.
Contestants showed their greasy pole climbing prowess on Sunday as they took part in a traditional festival in Malta. The 10-metre pole is slathered with grease, attached to a barge and draped at a precarious angle over the harbour. The aim is to run as far up the pole as possible and remove the flags at the end. For some competitors, the style in which they fell off the pole seemed to be slightly more important than reaching the flags. But others showed definite determination while clambering up that greasy pole.
Climbing the greasy pole is a metaphor for the struggle of competing in life, but as we will see, it can also be seen as a metaphor for the way each generation's struggle paves the way for the next generation to reach even further. Now, whilst you have probably heard this phrase used at some point, you may be surprised to learn that greasy pole climbing is in fact an organized sport with a long and diverse history that far predates the phrase's use as a metaphor. No one knows for sure when it was first played, but records of the game date back around 300 years. The game tends to come in two forms, climbing a vertical pole and walking across a horizontal one. Other than that, the rules are generally the same. Usually, over water for just a smidgen of safety, a pole is greased with something unpleasant and slippery, like lard or oil, and then competitors try to reach the end without falling off. Sometimes there is a prize at the end. Sometimes the chance for glory is all the motivation people need. And really, there is something for the whole community to enjoy. The young get to prove themselves and get a measure for each other, whilst the older folks get to laugh at the desperate, ungainly, and often futile attempts of the young, whilst reminiscing and reimagining about their own valiant attempts in the years past. Like so many traditional games and competitions, something about it being so old just seems to make people ignore the health and safety.
The Cheese Rolling Festival is back after a two-year break. I'm excited to see everything going back to normal. Yeah, no, I consider this going back to normal. This is what peak physical and mental health looks like in a general population. It is. Yeah, no, it is. How's your neck? He's all right. Is that a bloody flamingo? It's good to see they put a legal document on the fence this year. This is a professional event. Off goes another roll of cheese. This must be the women's sprint. Have a look at the Sheila on the outside in black and red. She is galloping ahead by 3 to 4 lengths. She's either going to win the cheese or break her neck. No in between. There's a comeback. No, she holds on. She's been sprayed in the face.
Different variations of this game can be found the world over. In Indonesia, Panjat Pinang is a sport involving groups of people working together to get one individual to the top of a vertical greasy pole to win prizes, ranging from home appliances to bicycles. It is most popularly played on their Independence Day, but has been around since Dutch colonial rule in the 1700s. In the UK, there are various examples of both the vertical and horizontal games dating back to at least the 1850s, with one competition in Blakeney dating back to 1873, in which competitors needed to walk to the end of a horizontal greasy pole in order to win a whole hog or some such prize positioned on the end. In July 2024, Grace Thompson became the first female to ever reach the end of the pole. Well done, Grace. Equally, in an oddly comical end to the US War of Independence, when British soldiers were withdrawing from New York, they greased the flagpole to make it harder for the Americans to take down the Union flag. It is also played in Turkey, Brazil, Taiwan, the Philippines, and of course, St. Lucia.
When the knee travels higher than the hip, it causes the legs to fatigue more quickly. That creates instability in the lower body, increasing strain on the knees. Taking smaller steps where the knee stays at or below the hip isn't just a smoother way to climb. It's also going to reduce knee strain on the way up and the way down. And place your feet at a 45-degree angle against the pole.
In 1904, greasy pole climbing was actually held as an event at the Summer Olympics. In what became an infamous stain on the institution, it was not held as a main event in which the winning athlete was awarded a medal. Instead, it was part of what they termed Anthropology Days, a side event in which indigenous people from around the world already present at the event in literal human exhibitions were paid to compete. They were not athletes, nor were they trained or even given proper instructions on how to compete in each event. Around 100 indigenous men were made to compete in a range of sports from shot put to greasy pole climbing to mudslinging, all in a twisted attempt by the event organizer, James Edward Sullivan, to gather data on the sporting abilities of indigenous competitors and scientifically prove the supremacy of the white competitors, naturally, in the least scientific way possible. In the end, the games went down as the most infamous and worst organized Olympic Games ever.
That was the 1904 Olympics, was the issue of location. With them lazy Wright boys not having double-decker Boeing 747s out yet, for foreign athletes, getting to St. Louis involved a lengthy boat trip, followed by a 1,000-mile train ride. Combined with the fact that the Russians and Japanese were having a disagreement at the time, a measly 12 nations showed up, with only 62 of the 651 athletes hailing from outside of North America. But the eye of the storm centered on the iconic marathon event. Instead of the typical morning start time, this one was held in the afternoon, where temperatures soared to 92 degrees Fahrenheit, with humidity in the 90s. Only 14 of the original 32 runners finished the race, the worst finish ratio in Olympic history.
So the game of climbing greasy poles has a long, rich, and with so many things, complicated history behind it. As we will see, the history and usage of the phrase as a metaphor is no less complex or nuanced. More on that in a moment, but first, our special guest joining me this week is St. Lucian-born Cornelius René. Not only does he feature in the UK show The Face Doctors, he has also been practicing for more than 25 years as a consultant ophthalmic surgeon, specializing in ophthalmic plastic surgery. Based in the National Health Service practice at Addenbrookes Hospital, Cambridge, England. He is a founding member,
former treasurer and past president of the British Occiplastic Surgery Society and a trustee and chairman of the Cambridge Eye Trust, a charity that is dedicated to supporting and funding research, innovation and education in eye care in the UK. Professionally, I know I should be welcoming you to the show as Mr. Cornelius Rene, but I'm very fortunate to know you as that youngster in St. Lucia with your short pants and the family running around and having a great time. So, Connie, thank you so much for being a guest on Metaphorically Speaking.
Thank you very much, Dee, for the invitation, very kind invitation. And also thanks to Dame Paulette and the rest of the Nobel Laureate Festival Committee for inviting me. I have been a fan of the Nobel Laureate Festival Committee many years now, and I have followed the festival because I'm in awe of our Nobel laureates and all that they've achieved in their careers. So I'm truly humbled to be part of this year's festival, especially as I know that the theme is acclaiming the trailblazers and inspiring the nation. So that's a very humbling thing to do. So thank you very much for the invitation.
The prefix of the theme is always celebrating excellence. And so when it was time for the committee to find or discuss people, I should say, that they wanted to be part of the festival, your name was right there. I was very shocked that one of the committee members actually sent me a link and said, we really need to have this person somewhere along in the festival. And Delia, I think because he is St. Lucian and he is in the UK, we must have Mr. Rene to talk to us about not only his career, but what everything is like. So she was very, very interested to find out what your chosen metaphor was. So, of course, when I told her, she just burst out laughing and then became very, very serious. And we actually had a very great conversation about that. And I'm talking about Mrs. Cecilia Lacobinier, who is the secretary of the Nobel Laureate Festival, and then also with our chairperson, Her Excellency Dame Paulette Luisi. The three of us had a good conversation and started laughing about it because we all had our different memories about that. And I'm sure that you have as well, which is why you chose that metaphor. So can you tell us why? What's your rationale of choosing climbing the greasy pole?
Yes, well, there are several aspects to the climbing the greasy pole, which actually I find resonate with my experience. Well, firstly, climbing the greasy pole, I mean, it's all about struggle. It really symbolizes struggle. And I can certainly say I've had my fair share of struggle in my professional career. But on the other hand, it does point to the fact that if you stick with it and you're determined, that you can actually get to the top. So that resonates with me. Another aspect is the fact that, climbing the greasy pole is not a solitary activity. You know, if you try to do this on your own, you're not going to succeed. You know, so you're doomed to fail. So you are dependent on other people to provide support. So I've been fortunate enough to have supportive family, very good friends, mentors, you know, who've been there all along in my professional career to advise and support. So that's been a good thing. Thirdly, I think if there are multiple attempts to climb the greasy pole, what inevitably happens is that you will remove grease from the pole and then it'll become easier for others to climb the pole after you. And again, that really resonates with me because, you know, as the first black oculoplastic consultant in the UK, I think I have probably degreased the pole to some extent for those who are coming after me. I've paved the way for them. I've made it easy for them to follow their own career paths. And finally, not so much a metaphorical aspect, but more of a literal aspect. When I think about climbing the greasy pole, my mind harks back to my childhood, and I have really very fond memories of seeing these men trying to climb the greasy pole, which used to be an activity that took place every year on the National Day celebrations, which is 13th of December. And it was always funny to see them climbing. It was always amusing. But again, the interesting thing was that, they would do it in groups. And inevitably, although it was always a struggle, they would inevitably succeed and reach the top of that pole. where they could get this ham, usually, which was hanging at the top of the pole as their prize, you know, the prize for reaching the top. So I always have very fond memories of that as well. So, you know, from all these aspects, I thought it was really a good metaphor to choose.
Tell us more about your childhood in St. Lucia, because, you know, the beginning of our lives, we've always been told that it's the basics of how we develop and how we grow. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes, well, I was born in Soufrière. Soufrière, for those who don't know, is a small town on the west coast of St. Lucia. So I was born there and I grew up there. I spent my early years there. And I have really very fond memories of growing up in Soufrière. You know, obviously we played outdoors quite a lot with other children from the neighborhood. And I spent a lot of time actually walking up to the countryside in Diamond. And, you know, we'd go and pick fresh fruits, mangoes and all sorts of delicious tropical fruit. And that was really very nice to do. So, yes, but I was actually brought up by my godmother, because my parents left St. Lucia when I was only a baby, really. My father left when I was 2 months old to come to the UK. Both my parents were part of the Windrush generation. You know, the Windrush generation, again, for those who don't know, are, you know, the people from my parents' generation who left the Caribbean and came to the UK. They came primarily because they were invited to come and sort of do jobs that a lot of the Brits didn't want to do. But also, you know, there was a labor shortage in Britain at the time. And so they came to help to rebuild the country after the Second World War. So my father left when I was 2 months old. My mum followed about 14 months later. And they left me in the care of my godmother, who was really the one who raised me. But before my mother left St. Lucia, she had asked my godmother to make sure that I received a good education. And my godmother promised her that I would. So I had a good primary school education in Soufrière. In fact, towards the end of my primary school education, my parents were actually trying to send for me to come over to the UK, but they were advised to leave me in St. Lucia because at the time I was actually doing very well. I was a bright lad you know, the prospects were very good. As it turned out, I actually won the government scholarship because I got the top marks in the entrance examination for St. Mary's College, which was really the top institution for secondary schooling at the time in St. Lucia. There were very few secondary schools available. And interestingly, both of our Nobel laureates also went to St. Mary's College. I went to St. Mary's College from Soufrière. But to do that meant that I'd have to leave Soufrière to go to the capital in Castries, which is where St. Mary's College was. And so that was interesting in itself because, you know, coming from a sleepy, small West Coast town to go to this bustling capital was quite an experience. But yes, I enjoyed my time at St. Mary's. I remember walking in there on the first day and you were initiated by all these bigger boys who, you know, would give you calots, as they called it, which is where they slapped your head as you sort of walked into school. And that was part of the initiation ceremony that you had to endure. I suppose that's probably been outlawed now because of, you know, child protection and so on. Yes. But it certainly was the case when I went there. Apart from that, I really had a very good time there. It was a very competitive environment. You know, I was always sort of striving to be the top of my class, and you were encouraged to be the top of your class, you know, and of course my peers wanted to do the same. So I had a really good education there. And then I left St. Mary's to go to do my A-levels at the St. Lucia A-level College at the Mourne. But then my parents decided to try a second time for me to come to the UK. So I suppose that was probably a better time to do that. So in retrospect, I think the decision to leave me back when I was at primary school was good. So I actually left. I started my A-levels at the A-level college, but then I left halfway through the first year to come to the UK. And so I had to start over again when I came here. I pursued my A-levels in London, and then I applied to go to medical school. But actually, you know, coming to the UK in the context of the climbing the Greasy Pole is actually where I think the Greasy Pole experience first started. Because, of course, when I came to school here, I remember meeting the careers advisor at my in my sixth form college, who asked about, you know, what I wanted to do, and I said, well, I want to be a doctor, and specifically, I want to be an ophthalmologist. And she asked why, and I said, well, you know, I've always had a fascination with the eye, and I like optics and so on. And she said, well, you know, have you considered a career as an optician? And if you think back to in those days, opticians really, all they did was prescribe spectacles and dispense them. You know, optometrists now do a lot more than that. But back in those days, you know, it was a pretty limited role. So I knew that's not what I wanted to do. So I discarded her advice. And I applied to Middlesex Hospital Medical School, which was part of the University of London. And I got admitted to Middlesex, which is why I pursued my medical school career. I was actually the only one black medical student in my year group of over 100 medical students at the time. So, yeah, that was actually quite an achievement on my part.
You mentioned a fascination with the eyes and knowing that that's the career path you wanted to go through. What happened? What created that fascination?
Yes, well, I remember seeing my grandmother as a young child growing up in St. Lucia. That's my paternal grandmother, who lived in a very rural part of St. Lucia in the south of the island. And she had obviously had cataract surgery at the time. But in those days, nowadays, when you have your cataract removed, you have a lens implanted into the eye, which will help you to focus. But in those days, you know, cataract surgery was pretty crude. So a lens was removed, and the only way she could see was to wear these really very thick glasses, which we call in my area aphakic spectacles. So she was wearing these aphakic spectacles, and she was obviously struggling to see with them. And I remember thinking, even as a child, that there must be a better way to give, you know, old people like my grandmother a better sight. And so that, I guess that was my first inspiration for wanting to do ophthalmology. But the other thing is, in those days, there were no resident ophthalmologists on the island in St. Lucia. So, you know, there was very little provision for people like my grandmother. So I was quite keen to pursue a career in ophthalmology and actually go back. It was my aim to go back and serve the people of my country. So that was always a dream for me.
According to a report published by the General Medical Council in 2022, only 6% of doctors in the UK are black, and only 2% of black people in ophthalmology, which is your specialty. When you were training, there were even fewer black doctors around, and you must have faced several challenges, did you?
Yes, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. I mean, as I said, I was the only black face in a year group of 100 medical students. So if my experience is anything to go by, I think there were probably only about 1% of doctors in the UK at the time were black. And there would have been, and I remember as a medical student, only knowing really one black surgeon in the UK. There's a surgeon called Bernard Ribeiro. He was a general surgeon. In fact, I applied for his house job. When you qualify as a doctor, you have to do a pre-registration job, which is called a house job. So I applied for his house job, and I was actually invited for interview, but I remember him taking objection to the fact that I said that I wanted to return to St. Lucia during that interview, so I didn't get the job. Mm-hmm. And then as a junior ophthalmologist, because then I always knew I wanted to do ophthalmology, so in fact, as a medical student, I actually went to Barbados and did a six-week student elective in the main hospital in Bridgetown, Queen Elizabeth Hospital. And I spent 6 weeks there observing ophthalmology. And that actually confirmed that's really what I wanted to do as a specialty. And then when I pursued my career in ophthalmology, I can only think of two consultant ophthalmologists at the time I was training. So, you know, there weren't many people like me. And of course, you know, if you see role models, that gives you the confidence that you can actually look up to them and you could aspire to be like them. But There were very few black role models that I could actually look up to in those days. So that is obviously a challenge. There were no support groups. I mean, at the moment, because they're more black faces in not just ophthalmology, but in medicine in general, there are more black doctors around. So these black doctors have been able to form their own support groups. There are black medics associations, there are mentoring groups and so on. I didn't really have that when I was training. So I had to figure things out for myself. That was a challenge. Another aspect which was really challenging was medicine in those days. After you did your house job, then you had to apply. There were many other jobs that you had to apply for as you climbed the career ladder. Whereas now, if you decide you want to be an ophthalmologist, then you apply for an ophthalmology training program. And it's a sort of 6-7 year run through program where you just go through that program. But when I was applying, I had to apply to become a senior house officer, then a senior house officer, registrar, senior registrar. And at all of these levels, I had to make multiple applications, and I'm sure I had to apply many more times than my white peers to even get an interview, let alone to be appointed to the role. So that was a challenge. But yes, I mean, as I said, I always knew that's what I wanted to do. I had self-belief. I believed in myself. And importantly, I had good mentors. And, you know, I remember one of my supervisors calling me to one side and saying, look, you know, I know you want to go back to St. Lucia and you think it's, and I thought it was a noble thing to have on my CV because, you know, I sort of want to be fully trained and go and offer my services to my country. But he said, no, you shouldn't include that on your CV because it could be misconstrued that you're not showing allegiance to the country that trained you. So, you know, it was good to have that sort of advice as a young doctor when I thought I was actually doing the right thing by sort of stating that I had aspirations to go back and help my country out. So that's why it is important to have this sort of mentoring and support, which, you know, I received from very good supervisors. But as I said, the fact that there weren't many black mentors, that, I think that was a challenge. And I did have to figure things out for myself. I mean, I've been quite comfortable being the only black face in, you know, most of the professional environments that I go to. I think it's nice to know that some of the others coming now can look up to me and think, well, Mr. Rene's got there and he's at the top of his profession, so I can aspire to be like him.
So let's be quite clear. Let's kind of define ophthalmology.
Yeah, ophthalmology is the study of eye surgery. So my profession really involves eye care, and it's a mainly surgical specialty, but there are some medical aspects to it where we, you know, it's not all about surgery. I trained as a general ophthalmologist, so I was trained in all aspects of ophthalmology, but very early on as a young ophthalmologist in training, I realized that I actually had an interest in ocular plastic surgery. You know, I had an aptitude I took to the surgery with great aplomb. So I decided I was going to be an oculoplastic surgeon. And for those who don't know what oculoplastic surgery is, it's basically the treatment and surgery of eye conditions that affect all the structures around the eye. So in my line of work, I deal with the conditions that affect the eyelids, the tear ducts, the eye sockets. So I will operate on anything from, you know, a droopy eyelid to watery eye to a skin cancer on the eyelid, or even sometimes cancer in the eye. So I think when most people think about ophthalmology, they think about, you know, just cataract surgery or maybe even glaucoma surgery. But although the eye is actually a very small organ, there are lots of different subspecialties within ophthalmology, and oculoplastic surgery is only one of them. And I'm thrilled to be doing that. It's a very exciting area. The work is very varied, and it's really very wonderful area of ophthalmology. So I'm pleased that I've made my subspecialty interest oculoplastic surgery, and I have really gained a lot out of it.
You also gained additional recognition, not just from your peers, but from the public, when you were featured in The Face Doctors, which is a television series that features world-class surgeons who undertake life-changing treatment of conditions affecting the face, neck, and head. How did that happen? How did you become involved?
The hospital where I work, Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge, is a world-leading teaching hospital. It's one of the top hospitals in the UK, and it's got, you know, a good reputation globally. So the hospital had been featured in a previous medical documentary series called Surgeons at the Edge of Life. And that series actually won awards, and it was screened on BBC television. And the same production company were invited to come back to Addenbrookes to film this series, The Face Doctors. So they invited me to take part. I had some trepidation about being involved, but in the end, I decided to do it. And the main reason why I did it was really, again, for the reasons why I've just said, that, you know, ophthalmology doesn't usually feature in programs such as that. So I thought it would be a good opportunity to showcase my specialty of ophthalmology, but even more importantly, show that it is more than just cataract and glaucoma. So in that series, I was filmed operating on a patient who had a cancer within her eye. So I had to do the eye removal and also rehabilitate the eye socket with a prosthetic eye, which, you know, the patient was very pleased with the result of that. And also, you know, it showed me collaborating with another colleague in another specialty, which is another really valuable aspect of my work, that I work with other top specialists, not just in ophthalmology, but in other areas. And so I was filmed operating with a maxillofacial surgeon on a patient who had a really horrible flesh-eating bug of the face. It was really a very good opportunity to showcase ophthalmology in good light. And I've had really positive feedback from family, friends, colleagues, even patients actually have said that they've seen me in the series. And that's really very heartwarming to receive that sort of feedback. So I'm very pleased that I did that.
Well, it was really nice to see you operating as well, because over the years, of course, I've known an area of what you've done, but for me to actually see it, it was just amazing. And of course, for the year 2024, we had the excellence of Julian Alfred, who won the 100 meters gold in Paris and the 200 meter silver. So, and also the Nobel Laureate Festival this year, one of the part of the theme is actually because of her excellence and excellence of other St. Lucians who have been putting St. Lucia on the map. St. Lucia, of course, is known very much in terms of its tourism, which is, you know, something that we rely on. But also now we also have our Nobel laureates, of course. We have Julian Alfred. We have other Caribbean laureates. We have Adrian. I'm trying to get all the surnames because I know most of the people with the first names. We have quite a few of them. And of course, we have you, who is showing your St. Lucian excellence abroad. We always say we like to highlight St. Lucian excellence at home and abroad. I mean, where do you, let me put you in a spotlight here. Where's home for you?
Well, I mean, obviously at the moment, home is at Cambridge in the UK. That's where I've been based for the last 26 years or so, coming up to 27 years. But, I mean, my heart is still in St. Lucia. As I said, I grew up there. I spent all my formative years there. I've still got very pleasant memories of St. Lucia. I've got family there, and it's always wonderful to go back and visit family and spend time in the country. So, my heart is in St. Lucia, but my home is here. I'll phrase it that way.
We've spoken a lot about climbing the Greasy Pole. We've spoken a lot about your childhood and coming back into the UK. Is there anything at all that you would like anyone to know about, whether it's your profession, whether it's about climbing the Greasy Pole, something that you'd like to share with your fellow St. Lucians?
Well, I would like to say that, you know, everything is possible. You know, I've been in, we've just found out throughout the course of this interview, I've been in a minority throughout my career, but that hasn't stopped me, you know. Although I've been in a minority, I've made very good friends, and I've had good mentors who have supported me. So if you, you know, I keep going back to the fact that you have to have self-belief and determination. So it is, everything is possible. Believe in yourself and keep striving hard, and you will get to the end of the road. So don't be put off by the challenges that you face. Just keep going, and eventually you'll get there.
Thank you. And of course, don't forget, if you don't know where your support is, there are many organizations, as Cornelius has said, that you can seek help to whichever profession that you would like to succeed in. So thank you so much, Mr. Cornelius René, for your time and for being one of the excellent St. Lucians that we are celebrating this Nobel Laureate Festival.
Thank you very much again, Delia, for the invitation, and thanks to the entire Nobel Laureate Committee for considering me. It's been a great pleasure taking part in this special edition of Metaphorically Speaking, and I wish the committee all the very best for the festival. Thank you.
What a truly special interview. Thank you, Cornelius, for those fascinating insights and for giving us a glimpse into your life and life in St. Lucia. Now, back to our metaphor. Sometimes the phrase can simply refer to the difficult nature of certain work. You struggle and struggle, only to make it a few inches higher. However, the connotation between Greece and both an unpleasant experience and sleeve and malpractice makes climbing the greasy pole a natural metaphor for describing career progression in certain competitive, elitist, or nepotistic fields. No wonder, then, that it has been used to describe the entertainment industry, the world of business, and the game of politics. When you play by the rules and do everything right, but still find yourself sliding backwards whilst others rise with half the effort, you might suspect that something slimy is afoot. Whilst he didn't coin the phrase, it was former British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli, who lived from 1804 until 1881, that popularized climbing the greasy pole as a metaphor. In 1862, having played a pivotal role in the fall of the previous government, Disraeli was asked to succeed the incumbent prime minister whose health was failing. As a non-aristocrat of Jewish heritage, Disraeli had faced an uphill battle his entire career. Now, after a lifetime of playing the game, moving and schmoozing, compromising and negotiating, it was finally his turn to lead. It is worth noting that despite Disraeli in many ways representing a smashing of the glass ceiling, he does in some ways prove its existence. He was only legally allowed to pursue a career as a politician because his father had converted the family to Anglicanism when Disraeli was 12 years old. And political cartoons throughout his career never failed to depict him with crude, exaggerated Jewish features. And whilst he may not have been an aristocrat, Disraeli believed, entirely incorrectly, that he was of high-born descent and made no attempt at all to address the overwhelming number of aristocrats in the government he inherited. He did make it to the top of the greasy pole, but only by greasing every inch below him.
Action may not always bring happiness, but there is no happiness without action. Benjamin Disraeli was known as a man of action and even willing to stand alone against the opposition if he believed in his position. He was clearly happy in politics as he served in government for 3 decades. Happiness is a different kind of value. It means a state of well-being with emotions ranging from contentment to intense joy. Now, while most people perceive happiness to be a passive value, something you experience, Benjamin understood that a state of happiness is something that requires work. You must take action to be happy.
Seemingly, every British prime minister since, from Churchill to Thatcher to Blair, has used this same metaphor to describe their experiences of politics, as did US presidents Theodore Roosevelt, Lyndon B. Johnson, and even Richard Nixon in his memoirs. Whilst the connection to the dirty game of politics is clear, I will leave it to listeners to determine how much grease they reckon stuck to each of those mentioned. The entertainment industry is no better, though, with Sofia Coppola, Michael Caine, Wes Anderson, and Peter O'Toole all using the greasy pole to describe their experiences making movies. It is interesting to note here that these individuals were most likely using the phrase in different ways. Sofia Coppola, daughter of the renowned director Francis Ford Coppola, was presumably not complaining about how nepotism and elitism has stood in the way of her career. Whereas Michael Caine, one of the first working-class Brits to make it onto the silver screen, very much was.
I don't believe in equality. I believe in equity. Mm. And there's a huge difference.
What's the difference?
Equality is you and me, we're dating. You make $500,000 a year. I make $50,000 a year. We go 50-50 on our rent on our apartment. It's equal. It's not fair. Whereas equity is if you and I are dating, you make $500,000. I make $50,000. And you pay for most of the rent and I pay for my portion. And it is prorated based on how much we make. Because it is then a comparable burden on our financial situations.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same percentage of your income as it is for me.
Sometimes it feels like the cards are so thoroughly stacked against you that you don't have a chance of reaching the heights of success and fame usually reserved for the privileged and powerful. Sometimes it feels like the system is rigged against you because you weren't born into the right family or you weren't handed a head start right out of the gate. But you know, if you think of it very carefully, if you allow others to go ahead of you, then take some of their failures into consideration and think of it like they are degreasing that pole so that when you keep on trying, eventually you will reach where you need to go because you have observed what others have done, how they failed, and how you can perhaps use that to help you to achieve. Well, in those moments, I invite you to remember that your struggle to climb, no matter how ungainly and hopeless it might feel in the moment, is decreasing the pole for everyone who comes after you. And if you don't make a great success of yourself, as Cornelius here, even if you fail entirely in your attempts to smash through that glass ceiling, so long as you try your best, your efforts are not for nothing.
Oh my, I think there's a metaphor there. Anyway, sometimes it feels like the cards are so thoroughly stacked against you that you don't have a chance of reaching the heights of success and fame, usually reserved for the privileged and powerful. Sometimes it feels like the system is rigged against you because you were born into the right family or you weren't handed a head start right out of the gate.
Well, in those moments, I invite you to remember that your struggle to climb, no matter how ungainly and hopeless it might feel in the moment, is degreasing the pole for everyone who comes after you. And if you don't make a great success of yourself, like Cornelius, even if you fail entirely in your attempts to smash through that glass ceiling, as long as you try your hardest and as long as you try your best, your efforts weren't for nothing. It meant something. And when someone does finally manage to break through to new heights, be proud that if it isn't you, that you've played a part in making it possible.
There's just one problem. World records are getting harder to break. For example, in July 2016, Kendra Harrison of the United States broke a record for the 100-meter hurdles that had stood for 28 years. The longer a sport's been around, the harder records are to break. Some scientists, like Peter Wayand of Southern Methodist University, have attempted to figure out where that limit is and concluded that the human body can handle forces that would propel a sprinter to 60 kilometers per hour. By comparison, the fastest sprinter yet, Jamaica's Usain Bolt, can only manage a measly 45 kilometers per hour.
That's all we have time for this week.
Thank you so much for tuning in, and a huge thank you to Mr. Cornelius Rennie for being our wonderful guest for the week. I'm sure many St. Lucians are thinking back to the Windrush times, thinking back to the times when young people followed their parents afterwards in the UK. And Mr. Rennie has shown us that once you keep on going and doing your best, you can excel and you can succeed. I hope you have enjoyed listening to this episode of Metaphorically Speaking with me, Delia Delore. I hope that you're left feeling motivated and inspired during, not just listening to the show, but during the annual Nobel Laureate Festival. If you're not in St. Lucia and you'd like to follow the events for the festival, you can follow them on Facebook at St. Lucia Nobel Laureate Festival. Also, let us know what you think of our discussions today. And if you have any greasy pole climbing stories you'd want to share with us, we really do love to hear what you have to say. And at least we can have a good laugh. Even imagining people sliding down that greasy pole makes you kind of snigger, doesn't it? Don't forget that you too can suggest a metaphor for future shows by reaching out to us at colourful.com/shows/Delia. If you have a friend or family member that you think would enjoy this episode, please send them the link. And feel free to leave a review on colourful.com or on our podcast, Metaphorically Speaking, which you can find on Apple, Spotify, and all major streaming platforms. You can also reach us by email, if you prefer, at info@metaphorically-speaking.uk. Your engagement is what drives this show's growth. Join us again for another phrase next week. Until then, I've been your host, Delia Delore. Have a great week. See you next time. And St. Lucia, congratulations. You're celebrating your 32nd Nobel Laureate Festival. Goodbye for now.
Metaphorically Speaking.
I can't give what you deserve from me. Whenever you talk, I have a hard time listening. Can't get through the day, but sometimes it gets rough at night. I want you and Hennessy to hold me tight.
Sober, lost in my emotions. Need something to focus, just to hold me over. I think I'm way too sober, sober, way too sober. I need you to come closer, even if it's just for closure. I think I'm way too sober, sober, sober.
For my chest, oh, I'd like to
Driving